Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Confessions of a Debut Novelist with me, your host, Chloe Timms. This week, I'm talking to Kayleen Steed about their thriller, Home. Kayleen is a writer, teacher, and an aspiring dog owner who lives in Helensburgh with their husband and son. They are also a short story and audio drama writer, winning the Pen to Print Audio Play Award in 2020. In this episode, we discuss creating a fictional cult, how an agency open day led to Kayleen signing with an agent, and how they beat the difficulties of trying to write something completely new. But first, here's Kayleen with an excerpt from Home.
The door to my building is standing open, but that's not new. The part of the city it's in isn't great, but my little flat is my sanctuary. It's small and too cold in the winter and too hot in the summer, but it's my own place, filled with my own things, and I know that as soon as I get inside, I'll feel much better. I can't quite see right. It's like there's shadows where there shouldn't be, too many of them, and at strange angles. I steady myself with a hand on the banister and drag myself up the stairs to my flat. I'll be okay once I get inside. I might not get into bed right away. I might strip off my soaked jeans, make a cup of tea in my favourite mug, the giant stripy blue one Meg gave me, wrap myself in my cosy winter blanket with the constellations on it and curl up on my squashy old couch. I'll nap there, and then later maybe read my book. If I feel like eating, I might even order a takeaway instead of cooking as a treat. Everything will be fine if I can just get inside. I have to pause on my way up the stairs. Black spots waft in from the edge of my vision. I need to sit down. My key catches in the door instead of clicking through smoothly. I must have forgotten to lock it this morning. I try the Yale lock and that's on properly at least. I push open the door and drop my keys and phone into the bowl on the little table just inside. I shuffle down the dim hallway to the kitchen. I'll put the kettle on first, then get into my pyjamas. There is a man sitting at my kitchen table. He is dressed all in black with a black overcoat folded neatly over the chair beside him. His hair is greyer than it was, but it is still recognisably him. He is tracing a design on the tabletop with one of his fingers, and he looks up as I come in. "Hello, Catherine," he says. My legs can't hold me, and I drop to the ground. There is a rushing noise in my ears and everything is overbright. This is not happening. He cannot be here. He is speaking. His mouth is moving, but I can't hear what he's saying. He stands and moves towards me, and I want to get up and run. I want to open my mouth and scream, but the black spots are back, crowding into my vision, flowing and merging into the darkness of him until the last of the light is gone, and they have blotted out everything.
Hi, Kayleen. Welcome to the podcast. I'm so happy to have you here with me today to discuss your debut novel, Home.
Thank you. I'm so delighted to be here.
So can you start by telling us what Home's about?
Sure. So Home follows Zoe, who as a child had escaped from a very secretive and repressive cult. But as an adult, she is lured back to the cult in an effort to rescue her sister.
And I will admit now, and I'm sure this is no surprise to anyone, that I am a big fan of any novel that kind of talks about cults or writes about cults. What interested you in writing about a cult, and where did the idea come from to write this book?
I've just sort of always been interested in cults, I guess. I just find them in religion more broadly. I just find it a fascinating topic. I think because I was brought up like with absolutely no kind of religious kind of practice. My folks weren't religious at all, so I always found that quite, I don't know, exotic or like fascinating, I suppose. Whereas I think if I'd grown up going to Sunday school every weekend, I might not find it quite as fascinating. So yeah, I've just always been fascinated by like ritual and the kind of like tight-knit community that you get from religions, and obviously to a far greater extent from kind of cults and cult-like groups. And I suppose the stories, sort of been writing it or versions of it for a long time. And I think initially the idea that later developed into Home was the idea of someone who'd escaped from a very restricted and isolated place and was then exposed to the world. And in earlier drafts, that was much more just that story of like the escape and what happened afterwards, which in Home has kind of changed now to this dual timeline. There's the kind of early years in the cult building up towards the escape. And then at the same time, you have the same character as an adult going back into the cult running parallel.
I'm curious then, because I know you write short stories. Did this ever kind of begin life as a shorter story?
Oh, I was like really resistant to writing short stories for the longest time. I was like, I'm a novelist, having never completed a novel. And I started writing short stories only when I did a master's in creative writing a few years ago, and they kind of encouraged you to like seek publication. You had like little tasks and things where you'd write short pieces. So I'd kind of done a few and fired them off, and I got a few published and things, and it was kind of good to add to like a kind of, I guess, a writing CV. It was a really good experience to like actually finish something for once. But yeah, I find writing short stories really tricky. Like just the idea of like containing something in like one very small thing. I think so. Short stories are way harder than novels, I think. So no, so at Home was always a novel.
So did you kind of start with this idea of wanting to explore the kind of psychology of a cult and what it would be like to come out of one, or was it Zoe herself that came to you?
What was it that came to me? I think it was the character and the opening, or the second chapter, at the very start, the idea of someone just working away, having this very normal life, and then this person from their past just reappearing. And then it turns out that this person has not had a normal life at all. Like they've had a very atypical and kind of crazy experience, but they've hidden it all away in the past. I'm really interested in that idea of like secret worlds or hidden worlds that only a few people get access to. On the one hand, that's a very like fantasy concept, but I think in the sense of having very closed societies, it can also be a really realistic concept as well. The idea that only a select few get to see this completely different way of experiencing the world. So I think that was the idea that really prompted, or the concept that really prompted the story.
Yeah, it's really fun as a reader to kind of have the knowledge that Zoe doesn't have, and to see her kind of navigate the world and culture and society and the kind of ordinary ways in which people behave. And it's when she's working in a cafe, I guess she's coming across A, so many different people, but also so much of life that we would take for granted as ordinary. And for her to kind of find her way around that in a way that's, I guess, socially acceptable is such a challenge for her. I wondered whether you could talk a little bit about your decision to explore this dual narrative, because as you said, you started with just the kind of aftermath of someone who has left a cult, but then we also get the, I guess, the story of how she escaped in the first place. So tell us your reasoning for telling both of those stories.
Oh, I wish there was like a really sensible answer. I was initially like a discovery writer. I wrote the first, I'm gonna say like half of the book, just discovery, over the period of like a number of years. And there was no like sensible reason. I think I just started writing like a flashback chapter, and then it just sort of like developed. Which then, got like smoothed over and made much more sense in subsequent edits. But yeah, I don't have like, I'm a bit of a pantser, so I don't really have a really sensible answer for that. I just sort of did it.
I say I reckon about 70% of guests I've had on the show have been pantsers or not really much of planners. So I'm gonna have to do the statistics one day and find out what the percentages are of planners versus pantsers. It's fascinating to hear how many people just write without a kind of idea of where it's going, but I guess that's the freedom of it.
Yeah, and it's like it, for me, it always works really well until about 30 to 40,000 words, and then I run out of steam and go, oh well, you know.
What makes you carry on at that point then? Because I would say more of a planner as a writer, so I have that goal in sight, I guess, even though that 30,000, 40,000 mark is always tricky. How do you, what kind of motivates you to keep going to the end? Or what with this book then motivates you to carry on to the end?
Well, with this book, I think this was before I did my master's. So at that, you know, at this point, I was very much writing just like in the evenings and stuff, and never really like seriously considered it would necessarily go anywhere. And I applied for, it was some kind of novel writing prize, and you didn't have to have a complete novel to enter, which was a huge draw for me. But as part of the entry, you had to send your first however many thousand words, but then also a really detailed plan of the rest of the novel. And I was like, I should probably make that up then. So I just made up the rest of the novel for this competition, sent it off, did not win said competition, but then I had a really detailed plan which I used for the rest of the book, so that all worked out really well.
So a reluctant planner then in this case.
Yeah, I think I start off kind of discovery and then eventually go, oh, I should probably plan.
Do you think, I mean, I'm guessing we'll talk about a little bit more about the next book later on, but has your way of working changed at all now you've got one book done?
For sure, yeah. I think as well, like the idea of like they expected, like no one was expecting this first thing that I read, except I wrote, except possibly like my mom. So you know, there was I worked on it over like years, like here and there. There was not much of like a kind of professional focus on it, you know, until much later in the process. But for the second one, there's very much a sort of like kind of pressure that I feel internally, I guess, to like, oh, I've got to write another book now. And you know, it's the difficult second album thing. And I don't know, I think I started writing, or wanted to write the second one in 2020, which was not a great year for like doing anything. And also had like a young child, and you know, the pandemic and working from home and all the stuff that everybody was having to deal with. So I think I basically didn't really manage that. I had a huge writer's block that year, and I tried to do all sorts of things to get going with it. So yeah, I really, really, really struggled. And previously, because I'd worked on this one book for so long, I knew the characters really well, I knew the story really well, and it was really disorienting starting again and being like, well, I have no ideas, I have nothing, like what do I do, where do these ideas come from, instead of almost having to like start from square one and generate something. So yeah, this has been a very, very different experience with book two.
Let's touch back on book one then, because that's what we're here to talk about. I wondered whether you could tell us a little bit more about the cult in Home. I wondered whether it was inspired by any real world cults, and also what kind of research did you do to get into that mindset of Zoe, where or Catherine, her other identity, what kind of research did you do to kind of get yourself in that place where you felt like you could write from that perspective?
I like I said, because I've always been fascinated by cults, I've like always been drawn to like documentaries, you know, books. I suppose more laterally when I was approaching the writing more seriously, reading interviews with people who'd been in cults was really really useful and really instructive. That whole thing of like how they adjust to the world outside, like what the like little details you might not sort of think of yourself that are kind of shocking or unusual to them, or that they find difficult. I remember reading a newspaper article about a girl who had been brought up in a very, very small cult to believe that she was sort of, I think she was supposed to be like the sort of second coming kind of idea. And when her and two of the women managed to like escape from this flat where they were being held, she just walked straight across the road and was almost immediately flattened by a bus because she'd like never walked across the road before. So even these really basic things like interviews with people who've had those experiences were particularly useful, I think, with coming up, particularly with how Zoe responds to the world in her adult narrative.
Were there any sort of particular religions or cults that you used as, because well, I'll talk a little bit in a second about your world building, but were there any, because I to begin with, and I started reading your novel, I wondered whether it was based on a real cult, but you very much have it very much has its own identity. So was there any kind of particular cult you kind of gravitated towards to read about?
No, but there was like types, I guess, like the very fundamentalist kind of, women are for having babies, men are for doing the things, kind of cults.
There are
Was
a lot of those.
yeah, like so many, almost all of them, really. So few cults with a matriarchal aspect, which is a shame. Funny that. So yeah, those that kind of vibe was I think the one that I wanted to look at, because it's so restrictive, but it's also very much something that, like, a lot of the attitudes that you have in these cults are not necessarily actually that niche. Like, and I think particularly in recent years, there's been such a backlash against LGBTQ plus people and so on. Like, I think we're seeing some of these re regressive attitudes kind of take hold again. So read a lot about like different kind of cults, and tried to take like the cult that I have in the book. The idea was very much that it has like a philosophy that just kind of like whatever works, they'll use it. There's not necessarily a really like coherent, committed spiritual kind of like meaning behind it. It's essentially a kind of, I think a lot of these things are like a kind of scam. There's a lot of people who are very believe, committed to it and believe in it wholeheartedly, but you've got a top layer of people who are manipulative, and they use these as a means of controlling people. As a result, there's, like any scam, they take bits and pieces of what's going to work. So there's a lot of bits of it that were inspired by various things, but it wasn't based on one particular cult.
Well, the simple fact that the first thing they make people do is give away their money is the indication that, I mean, I'm sure there are lots of similar scam slash cults that do the same, but that's their first test. If you're willing to give away all your money, then they've got you.
This is it. And it's the sunk cost thing. Like, once you've given up your time, and once you've given up your money, and once you've given up, more and more things, then it gets harder and harder to back out.
So let's talk a little bit about your world building. I know that this was something when I wrote my novel, I had a lot of fun with, but also getting the rules straight in your mind can be difficult because you basically have infinite choices to make. So tell us a little bit about how you decided on the hierarchy, the beliefs. I mean, there's even points where you build in your own scripture and language and roles within this. So how did you kind of, on a practical writing level, how did you do this?
A lot of it was sort of back engineered, and partly that's because from the main character's perspective, and we're in first person the whole way through, she only sees her very small part of it. We only see the leader of the cult once, like as a physical person in front of her. Like, she's not someone who's privy necessarily to like the inner workings of it and the kind of mass thing. She just sees these little snatches. So while I was writing the story in a fancy sort of way, I was just blithely like, doo, doo, just like throwing stuff in, and then at the end, it was pointed out to me that I needed something sort of like consistent. So I did need to go back and kind of think like, okay, what do they believe? What are the rules? In what ways? Even if this isn't something that the character, especially as a young child, like knows, this is, you do have to have a rule, because that's going to govern how she experiences things and what she's led to do and so on. So a lot of it was kind of, I guess, like looking, like you say, at these kind of examples of cults that are like this, and thinking, okay, like how do they enforce these repressive and restrictive rules? How do they justify it? And a lot of it is to do with this idea of like, well, what's pure and what's natural, and what's our original state, or this belief in what our original state or the some hallowed good old days was like, and kind of taking a lot of those kind of principles and using those to like make up rules, and then bring in like scripture and that kind of like cod biblical language. A lot of that was influenced, the sort of biblical language was influenced by a book called, oh, John Wyndham's book. He wrote The Midwich Cuckoos, but he also wrote a sort of like futuristic book about a sort of future society where had kind of survived this huge like tribulation, and as a result
Is
has
that the chrysalids?
yeah, the chrysalis.
Yeah, I read that.
Wow.
I read that as research for my novel as well.
Yeah, it's so good. And it like it does that kind of like cod biblical language so well. So a lot of that was kind of like inspired by the way John Wyndham approached that.
I had to write scripture for my novel, and it's funny, I only wrote a couple of paragraphs of it to spread out throughout the novel, and yet those tiny paragraphs took me hours and hours. It's getting the language so right that it sounds. In fact, I have had people ask me, did you make that up, or is that from an actual like biblical text? And I'm like, no, I made it up.
There is that like that real tone and cadence and stuff, and yeah, like it's very recognizable.
It's fun to do though, and it kind of pushes you as a writer, I think, to kind of make these things feel so believable, because you are constructing this cult or this kind of faith that's going to be believable as well.
Yeah, you have to believe that people would really sign up to it. And it's almost harder to do in fiction because there's a lot of stuff, and I'm sure you find the same researching cults, that you're like, if I put this in a book, you're like, it would just seem nonsensical, and like no one would believe this. But people do believe the most outlandish things. And I suppose a lot of it is because it looks outlandish from the outside. Like when you like we're discussing this in the run up to Christmas, and I have a pine tree downstairs in my living room that I put shiny things on, like why though? Do you know, like that's, you'd never seen that tradition before, you'd be like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
So I suppose everything looks odd from the outside.
Definitely. So one thing you've got as a balance to this darkness and this cult is the kind of lighter, more hopeful moments that Zoe experiences in the cafe with Meg, and also there's a section where she goes clothes shopping, and there's also her relationship with Addie as well. So how important were these scenes for you to kind of balance the darker stuff that we read as well?
Oh, really important. I think it's hard to stick with a story all the way through if it's just dark and depressing and your character is just getting ground down by life all the time. Like you have to have these hopeful moments, especially because I think they're where your character shines a lot. You know, you're seeing who they are when they're much more unrestricted. And they're a lot nicer to write. The romance with Addie was one of my favorite things to write. I loved when I knew I had a chapter of that coming up. I was like, oh, thank God. So that was, yeah, it's fun to write. I hope it, yeah, like you say, it does lift the mood, but it also gives you an indication of like why, what does this person have to lose? You know, if they go, Zoe goes back to the cult to try and rescue her sister, but if we felt like her life was just awful and drudgery, like why, you know, what's the issue with going back to the cult? But knowing that she has this life that she's fought very hard for, and it has these moments of joy and friendship and connection, gives that kind of quest that she goes on so much more meaning.
Yeah, those chapters with Addie were lovely, and I also really, really enjoyed Meg as well. So I definitely
My
think
favorite
yeah.
character.
Yeah, they those I think I get that sense from you, just from reading the book, actually. One thing you explore in both sections, I guess, is Zoe's identity, which she wrestles with, not just who she is, but how she fits into the world, how she fits into the cult. And I think often when we write about cults, not whether we realize it at the time or not, we're often trying to say something about kind of contemporary life. Did you go into this novel with an idea of what you wanted to say, or what your themes were going to be, or did they kind of come through the writing process?
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
They very much came through the writing process. And I think theme is something that, like, for me, I don't know about yourself, but for me, it very much comes in like a second or a third draft. Especially if someone else has read it and they've been like, oh, this is about identity. And you're like, yeah, I know it is, isn't it?
That's what I meant all along.
Of course it is. And you read it and you're like, no, yeah, that's what I'm writing about. And yeah, so I think that a lot of that comes in later. And yeah, very much about that idea of like, how do you form an identity when you spend so much time being told what your identity is and not being given an option to explore it for yourself? And you mentioned the character of Meg, and she really represents the person that allows or helps shepherd Zoe into being able to make those decisions for herself, rather than she's the kind of mother figure in the book, whereas the kind of shadowy figure that pulls Zoe back into the cult, the Hand of God, is this kind of like twisted father figure. And Meg is the mother figure that kind of gives her this kind of like gentle introduction to the world, but kind of lets her go off herself as well, like you would hope you do with a child, whereas the cult and the Hand of God are much more controlling and didactic.
Yeah, and I think as well, like there's times where even within the cult that she's brought up in, she doesn't really feel like the role, these kind of narrow roles represent how she feels about herself either. So it's not like the cult gives her that sense of belonging. And even when she's in the kind of the real world, as we might call it, she's still navigating who she is, how she feels, who she fancies, like those big questions that she hasn't had the space and the time to work out. And like you say, Meg is great for kind of giving her permission to basically experiment and do what she wants.
Yeah. And that was kind of her function as a character. And then she's also very much there for the, like, the lighter parts of the novel. Like she was quite fun to write because she's very sarcastic.
So you've already talked a little bit about your writing process and in the fact that you are not much of a planner, but yeah. I heard an interview with you where you talked about kind of writing routines and how to build one when life gets in the way, basically when you have other responsibilities or work. So can you tell us a little bit about how you write and how you fit in writing kind of into your day, how it was for Home and maybe how it is now?
Sure. Well, Home was written, I suppose the vast chunk of the manuscript in terms of what survives was written between like 2016 and 2019. And at the time I was working full time, I was doing this master's in the evening, and I also had like a 1-year-old baby, and that's not a work-life balance. I don't know. Looking back, I don't know when I got the time to write. I just did it every so often, I suppose, when I had the time. And that's very much not how I work now. I'm trying to like prioritize rest and occasionally like, you know, sleeping and eating and having a social life and things. So I'm lucky now that I have a job that allows me to work 4 days a week. So I have 1 day a week just to dedicate to like writing stuff. So it's much easier to just like silo off, like, okay, that's the writing day, do all the kind of writing things on that day. And I find it quite useful to start off by like, you know, getting rid of like admin as a kind of settling in thing. And then the afternoon is like head down, try and get however many words you're going for the day. So having like a really specific chunk of time is very helpful. But then, you know, obviously, like when I wrote the first manuscript, that wasn't the case, and it's not the case for a lot of people. And in that case, I think you just have to kind of do what you can. And also, that means, you know, you can't necessarily, and if you're the kind of person that isn't going to get up at 5 a.m. and write 2,000 words, then don't get up at 5 a.m. and write 2,000 words. Like, write 100 words on your phone while you're like in a queue for something, you know. Like, you do what you can when you can, when it works for you, I think. And I think going through a process of finding out what works for you is really important for people.
Mm. What aspect of writing is the one that you find most challenging, and how have you worked to get over it, basically?
I think I said before, I found getting started on book two really hard. So yeah, I just suddenly, after years and years of working on one thing and occasional like little projects in between, just not having a big project, I found really hard. How did I get over that? I spent a lot of time banging my head against the wall and writing things and then deleting them in disgust, which wasn't working. So then I tried to very consciously like not write and just like read a lot, read widely, watch a lot of like different like TV shows and movies, and like consume like art and music, and just try and like be inspired and just see where that led me. I did like scrapbooking, and I was quite into like bullet journaling at the time, which I did very, very ineptly, but it made me happy. So I did like a lot of that, with not necessarily the pressure of feeling like I have to create the next novel, but just like what's something I'm interested in. And Scarlett Thomas, who wrote like The End of Mr. Why, I absolutely love her. She has a book called Monkeys with Typewriters.
I love that book.
It's so good. And it has that section about creating a matrix of, you just put in all the stuff that you're interested about and all the stuff that you know about and the stuff that's like in the news and what's like an object you like. And you just randomly put these elements together and see what comes out. And that's what I ended up doing. And that's how book two came about. But then also just doing like writing without the pressure of feeling like I have to write my next novel right now. There was an interview with N.K. Jemisin, who wrote the Broken Earth trilogy. It was also wonderful, and she was writing about how she secretly writes fan fiction, and she's like, she publishes it anonymously, and she's like, you'll never know it's me, but I've written so much and I'd never done that. And I was like, oh, I'll try that. And I sat down one night and I wrote like 10,000 words in a night, because I was like, this is so, because the world's already there for you, you know, you're just having fun. So I think, yeah, the thing that I found really difficult was like restarting a new project, feeling a bit blocked and overwhelmed by it. And I guess I got past it by just allowing myself to be creative, rest a bit, and have fun with it again.
You've written short stories, as we mentioned, part of your MA course, and you also wrote an award-winning audio play. So I would like to know, how does writing in different forms support your novel writing? And was writing, I mean, you've mentioned, do you think short story writing is harder? But what was your approach to novel writing compared to these two other kind of different ways of writing?
I think my approach to novel writing was probably like really unearned confidence. I think I just always had this idea from when I was a very young kid that I could just like, of course I could write a whole book. Like I was just too young and stupid to question it until it was too late. Whereas like, yeah, short stories and audio play, like the audio drama came about because I was doing the masters, and for one of the projects you had to write something that wasn't in your like your usual style. So if you wrote poetry, you had to write prose and so on. So I my main focus during that was like writing the novel, and I was a bit like, oh this is so annoying. And so I was like, what can I do really quickly? And I was like, write a radio drama, that'll be super easy. And then it wasn't. I was very kindly, one of my lecturers gave me a link to a gentleman at the BBC, I think Radio 4, who like commissions radio dramas, and they were like, oh, we can give you some feedback. And this poor man, I sent him like this mess, absolute mess of a script, and he wrote me this very polite email back explaining in detail, very gently, why it was terrible.
Oh no.
He was so lovely, and I was like, I'm so indebted to him, because I was like, oh yeah, no, that's right. So after that, I just like rewrote it and kind of scrapped it and wrote what became the audio play that went for the competition. So yeah, lots of unearned confidence is probably the mixing line between these. But then also like listening to feedback, if people are good enough that they'll give you their time and expertise, then I think you always want to listen to people and respond and use that to guide and improve your work.
So what was your route to getting an agent and then your book deal? What was your experience like with that?
Probably surprisingly smooth. Spend way too much time on Twitter, and it really panned out for me because I follow a lot of like agencies and, you know, literary journals and publishers and like bookie people. And point I saw this tweet come up from a literary agency saying, oh, we're having an open day in Edinburgh, completely free. Anyone can sign up for a slot. We'll read your first chapter and we'll give you feedback on it. And most literary things seem to happen in London. And I was like, oh my God, Edinburgh, I can get to Edinburgh on a train. And I signed up, and I was the very last slot of the day. I was the last one, so it was very well timed. And I went along to it, and I met Robbie Guillory, and he read my first chapter, and he was like, "Oh, I really like this. I'd love to read the whole book." And I was like, "Great, there's no book. I'll finish one for you if you like." And he was like, "Awesome, send it to me when you're done." So I think like 6 months later, I sent him a full draft, and then he read it. Took him a couple of months, and then it was like December 2019, we met for a coffee at Waterstones in Glasgow, and he offered representation. So it was actually really smooth, and I think in the meantime I'd fired off maybe like a couple of like blank kind of, once I'd finished the manuscript, I'd fired off a couple of emails to agencies and kind of hadn't gotten anywhere with it. But I was very lucky because I know a lot of people spend a long time and query a lot of agencies. But I think the open day thing was just amazing. I think more agencies should do them because it just gets you that kind of face-to-face contact, which I think is really important. And that one was like, you know, you didn't need a contact. You didn't pay for it. As long as you could like get yourself to this place, it was available to you. So I think it's something more agencies to do. And I think now that, you know, people are so much better with online communication, that's something agencies could do without even the necessity of being physically there, which would make it more accessible to people.
I think I've seen one agency that are doing one end of December, beginning of January or something. And I think that's a great opportunity for people to, I think like you say, sometimes it's just meeting people, it's getting some sort of foot in the door, which if you're not very confident at writing a query letter or a synopsis, it can be that. I mean, obviously you've still got to pitch your book somehow, but it can be helpful to meet these people and make an impression rather than just them receiving an email, which could be from anyone.
Yeah, absolutely. And like synopsises are awful. Like I don't
they
know
they are the worst.
The worst. And I think as part of this, I did have to write a synopsis as well. And Robbie was like, "Yeah, your synopsis is dreadful. Like, first chapter is grand, but the first synopsis is so bad."
So you signed with your agent in end of 2019. Mm-hmm. At what point did you get your book deal? Was it much longer? Did you do much work with your agent on the kind of editing of your book, or?
Yeah, he was very hands-on. Robbie was great. So we went through, I think, one or two revisions of the manuscript, and then started shopping it around in the summer-ish of 2020. And then it got sent to Raven Bloomsbury towards the end of the summer. And in August, I remember I got a call from Robbie. I was like halfway up a mountain, and I got a call from Robbie saying, "Oh, Raven are interested." And I was like, "Great." And he was like, "They want you to cut 20,000 words from the opening first." I was like, "Oh God." And he was like, "It's not an offer of publication. They would like to see a revised manuscript." And I was like, "Sure, what else am I doing?" So Sarah Helen Binney, who became my editor at Raven, had very kindly taken the time to write a very detailed kind of feedback letter about, you know, we're interested, but we'd like to see more changes before we kind of say yay or nay. And I thought all the changes she suggested were really great after spending a while sobbing at the idea of like cutting 20,000 words. So I did that, resent it back. And then in December 2020, heard from Raven that they wanted to publish it.
Brilliant. Quite a long wait though from then till publication.
It was 2 years, which I think everyone in your life who is very sensibly knows nothing about publishing is your book still coming out, like is there something wrong with it? You're like, no, this is normal.
I think it was my dad that questioned was this just my book that was taking ages, or was it everyone's? So I was like, no, don't worry, it is everyone's. It's not just me.
Really normal.
Yeah. So I know it's really early days for you as an author, but if you could share one piece of advice for writers who are about to become debut novelists, or let's say the 2024 debuts, what would your advice be?
Oh, try and build a community, I think. Because I think writing can be quite isolating, but actually there's so many opportunities for it to be a really like collegiate thing. You know, like you work with your editor, you work with, you know, your agent and various kind of like copy editors and so on. So there's that aspect of it. But outside of that as well, like trying to make links with other writers, I found that to be incredibly rewarding. And not necessarily for like a kind of like industry networky kind of reason, but for a kind of like moral support and community kind of reason, so that you have people to message when, you know, something's happening in publishing and you're like, is this normal? And they're like, it's normal, don't worry. So that's really useful. And then you can share your journey with people and get advice and make connections. And it's quite a, I suppose it's quite an unusual thing to be an author, and you might not know anyone in your immediate life. So it's nice to make these connections with people, even if they're just kind of online, and they can become offline friends as well, which is very nice.
Yeah, definitely. So finally, I'm very, very eager to hear more about this elusive book too. Please tell us something about it.
Oh God. What can I tell you about it? It's not finished. It's not the same genre. So This one is, so I'm saying fabulism. I was saying magical realism, but I think that's very much a term that needs to be applied to South American literature because it has a politically sort of specific political dimension. It's that sort of idea. So like an everyday kind of world, but there's this one little element of it that someone comes across, and it gives them this access to kind of a hidden world. And it is very much inspired by, I guess, like grief, but also expanding or exploring into different spaces or different realities, and what it would be like to have access to that but also have one foot in the real world. And one of the characters is grieving, and I suppose that's something that does kind of shunt you out of the normal world a little bit. You suddenly experience life very differently from other people. So yeah, that's where we are just now.
Well, that sounds great to me. I'm really looking forward to reading it whenever that may be. Thank you so much, Kaylin, for joining me on the podcast today.
Thank you very much for having me. I've really enjoyed our chat.
That was Kaylin Steed talking about their thriller, Home, which is out now and available to buy. And if you'd like to support this podcast, debut authors and independent bookshops, you can now shop in the Confessions of a Debut Novelist bookshop, hosted by bookshop.org, which I've linked down below in the show notes. If you fancy buying any of the books you've heard on this podcast, then the majority of them can be found in this bookshop. And if you can, I would really appreciate you supporting me, supporting the authors and independent bookshops by buying them through this online store. Thank you so much for listening. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Or if you've subscribed already, it would be great if you could leave me a review. See you next time.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight. and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.